This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. In the next 20 years, the number of American senior citizens could top 80 million, and roughly one in every 10 of those seniors will be in the LGBT community. Coming up in the second half of our show, we'll talk with a local doctor and lawyer about the challenges facing an aging LGBT generation. But first, a few weeks ago, a small plane crashed into a building in Fort Myers. A week later, another plane crash landed in downtown Cape Coral. Then came reports of a small plane from Miami crash landing in a remote part of the Everglades. While officials investigate to determine the exact causes of each of these crashes, the coincidence of their occurring so close together can lead to speculation or questions about how safe our skies are. Joining us to talk about the safety precautions in place for all aircraft, great and small, is National Transportation and Safety Board investigator Leah Reed. Thanks for joining the show today.
Yes, hi, Julie. Thanks for having me on.
Also with us today to talk about all of the training and flight hours that pilots go through to get their license is flight instructor Ed Fink. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you.
We're talking about the recent small plane crashes in Southwest Florida. Do you have a question or a comment, or are you a pilot or a pilot in training? Give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. First, Leah Reed, as an investigator with the NTSB, what happens when a plane crashes? When does your organization spring into action?
Great question. We have a duty officer who's on duty 24/7, and they get notified through either the FAA or the NTSB Regional Operations Center. And we also have a rotational list of investigators who are on call. So when the duty officer gets a call that there's been an accident, they will get in touch with the investigator in charge who is next on the list to respond to one of these accidents and get them notified. And then, of course, we will get in touch with the local law enforcement that are on the scene to kind of get the wherewithal, if you will, about the nature of the accident, the location, the circumstances that are known up to that time. And then the investigator will make arrangements to launch to the accident site. And then once they're on scene, they'll begin the procedure of the on-scene portion of the investigation.
So at every airplane crash, every small or large, there's always an investigator from the NTSB on site? At some point?
We do normally on the fatal accident, we're launching an investigator out to the accident site. However, we are mandated by Congress to investigate accidents here in the United States. So what we do is if there is an accident that is defined by our regulation, then we assign an investigator to work. However, if there's a fatal accident, usually we're launching out to that particular accident and we'll be on scene.
So why is it so important to pinpoint a precise cause for an aircraft crashing?
Well, as you know, we determine the probable cause or causes for an accident. We would like to know what's causing these accidents so we can determine what happened and how we can prevent it from happening again.
Mm-hmm. And how do you determine what causes an accident? Is it looking at the mechanics? Is it looking at the actions of the pilot in the moments leading up to?
Well, we look at several things when we're at an accident. We want to do a very fair and thorough investigation, and we look at man, machine, and the environment. We look at the pilot, what was his or her overall experience, training, you know, their health. We'll look at autopsy, toxicology. Then we look at the machine, the aircraft. We'll look at the recent maintenance that was done on the aircraft. Was it being maintained? Did anything mechanically happen? Was the engine operating? Then we look at the environment. You know, what was the weather at the time of the accident? What environment from, you know, from, say, an air traffic control perspective? Was it a busy or congested area? So we want to take a look at all of this and see the big picture of what was going on at the time. And from that, we can kind of get a picture of what probably happened.
Mm-hmm. And here in our backyard, the recent crashes in Southwest Florida, we had two accidents in the immediate area. The first was a crash into the Chico's building in which the pilot survived. The passenger was killed. Has the NTSB determined what was the cause of that accident yet?
No, and I understand that there were, you know, the recent accidents here lately, but they're very much all in the preliminary and initial stages of the investigation. And usually our investigations will take somewhere from 6 to 9 months to complete. So I wouldn't anticipate a completion of that report for that period of time.
And the NTSB is not going to come out with speculation and say, well, we kind of think this. They're going to wait until the complete report's done.
That's correct. And probably what we do after each, well, not what we do, what we do after each investigation, I should say, is we issue a preliminary report. And that is available on our website, which is ntsb.gov. And then the factual report is issued about 6 to 9 months later. And then a few months after that, the final report is released. And that report will have the probable cause.
Okay. So in the preliminary report, that takes about how long?
That we get that out usually within 5 days from the time of the accident to when we return back to our office and get it out. So it's usually within a week.
Okay. And so, Ed Fink, you've been a flight instructor here in Fort Myers for a number of years. Is this a tight-knit community of flyers and small planes?
Yes.
So when something like this happens, do you watch pretty closely to see what the reports are? I mean, do you kind of chat about this?
Well, we look at the report, and then knowing that the final report's, you know, probably 6 months to a year away. So don't speculate. That's a big mistake. Just don't speculate. Wait till you get all the facts. And the NTSB, they're going to give us the facts. So that's the best thing to do.
So how do pilots react when things like this happen? Do they kind of come together?
Yes.
It's a close community. So did you know these guys?
Yes.
You did? Were you able to maybe connect with anybody and share any thoughts or
I try not to. I get a lot of questions from people. I've got some questions from the media, and I avoid that. I say, just wait till the official investigation's over. Some members of the flying clubs, you'll get someone that wants to speculate, and I say, don't speculate. Wait till we get the report.
Yeah, not necessarily speculation, though, about the cause of any of the accidents or anything like that. But do people get together to just kind of, you know, maybe talk about these people and offer support to one another and family members?
Yes, we had a ceremony of life, kind of a celebration of Mark Scott, the fatality, and Chico's. And so, yes, we do that.
Yeah. Is there a time of year when we tend to see more accidents than other times of year, or is it always random, Ed? I mean, you've been teaching for a while here. Do you see like a cluster of accidents and then not? Is there any rhyme or reason to it?
Rare that there's a cluster, and they're very random, and I don't think they have any season or anything like that. It just, you know, our weather's perfect for flying most of the time.
Yeah, it is. So there's going to be a lot of air, traffic out there, a lot of people, a lot of activity.
Yes.
And there's not going to be a spike of activity a certain time of year. For example, in the Midwest, when the winter finally breaks, people might take to the sky a little bit more readily.
Yeah, here the flying's year-round. And I stay busy. It doesn't make any difference what the season is. We call the season here, you know, when people come down. But a lot of people here are doing flight training, too. So it can be pretty even.
So, Leah Reed with the NTSB, I don't want to talk about these recent crashes as far as speculating what happened there, but speaking generally overall, what is the leading cause of small airplane crashes? Is it operator error usually, or is it mechanical malfunction?
Another great question. We work a lot of accidents, and we've certainly seen accidents where pilots may have contributed to the accident, but we also see mechanical. I don't have specific statistics on that, but we have certainly worked accidents where there have been an involvement with the pilot.
So are there any other patterns that you can point to when it comes to weather or training that can help understand a spate of recent plane crashes, or is it kind of a coincidence?
Well, in general, are you talking about the ones that have recently happened down in Florida?
Well, they kind of seem to happen in groups. Back in 2015, I was reading there were about five small plane crashes that happened within a couple of months in South Florida, but that was in September, October. They just kind of happen in spurts, it seems.
Well, I think Ed actually answered that very well, to be honest with you, because, you know, Florida is a very big state. It's dynamic in the situation, like Ed was saying, is that you can fly pretty much year-round. The weather's beautiful. There's a lot of flight training schools down there. You have a lot of big cities that people are flying to and from. So, it's almost like you have a lot more boats down there. You might have more boating accidents because just the nature of the environment down there.
Oh, we do. We did a show on that a couple weeks ago.
We do.
Yeah, okay. We have more boats, so we have a lot more boating accidents and a lot of coastline.
Right.
and then also the lakes and the rivers. But, so the summer is a very turbulent time of year as far as the weather is concerned. So obviously thunderstorms are an issue. But in the summertime, do things like extreme heat or humidity have any impact on someone who's flying?
Is that a question for me or for
Ed? Yeah, that's for you, Leah.
Well, I think every time a pilot gets in the airplane, you need to be more, you have to be familiar with what's going on in the weather and how your aircraft's going to perform. And also, you as a pilot need to be aware of your fitness as well. So, I just think in general, you know, you have to be aware of the environment. You have to be aware of the weather and what's happening. And how the heat's going to affect that. And that's all part of your pilot training.
Mm-hmm. And Ed, as a flight instructor, what kind of things are pilots taught in case of mechanical failure?
Well, most of your checklists published by the manufacturer, they'll go through several different things, like engine failure on takeoff, engine failure at altitude, you know, alternator failures. So we go through all that and try to cover that. The thing is, you can get complacent. So me, I fly a lot, and I try to remember, don't get complacent about what's going on. Think about it could happen right now, and I do that. Like every time I taxi out, we get ready to take off. I think to myself, this is the time. Be ready. And that's what you're doing, see? So you kind of stay on top of it.
So what's an example of something on that checklist that might tip you off to an issue before you take off?
Oh, well, fuel contamination, good. Improper run-up of the engine, you're not getting the proper indications on the instruments. That could tell you something. So anything, if you see anything that's wrong, the conservative course of action, don't fly, don't take off. So stay on the ground and find out what's wrong.
Yeah, but do you find pilots maybe have the pressure that they just want to get somewhere and they go ahead and take off?
It's called external pressures.
Yeah.
Some, I guess it could happen.
Yeah. If you're just joining the show, we're talking about small aircraft over Florida with an investigator from the NTSB and with a local flight instructor. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. And Ed, what kind of people do you have coming in to learn how to fly? Do you have a lot of retirees who've always wanted to learn to fly and suddenly have time?
It's across the board. I'll have young kids right in high school. In college, come to learn to fly. I have working people that's, you know, run a successful business. And then I have retirees that come down. So just all across the board. It's no, you know, not one specific group.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of aircraft do you work with?
Cessna 172, Cessna 182, basically Cessna and Piper aircraft.
Oh, so these are the smaller ones that
yes, single engine, single engine land.
Single engine land.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean? Not an airboat?
Not sea.
Not sea
not
where
an
they
amphibian. Well, not an amphibian.
Yeah, the ones that land in the water.
Yeah.
That would be a different animal for sure. So, what is required for someone that wants to take to the throttle? Does everyone who flies have to have a full pilot's license?
Yes, you can have it. Well, you can have a student license. You apply for a student license, and then, you know, you go through your training. See, like I teach ground schools through the Adult Community Education Program. So you have to pass a knowledge test, the FAA knowledge test. Then after you get your training, how many hours it takes, you have to have a minimum of 40. It takes more than that normally. Then you have to take a check ride by an examiner and pass that check ride. Then after that, you have to have a flight review, which is every 2 years, or unless you get a new rating. See, so people, sometimes they'll get a private pilot license. Next thing they do, they go get their instrument rating. And then, you know, some of them get a commercial license at that time. There's a difference between a license and a rating. Like a private pilot is a license, okay? An instrument is a rating. So multi-engine is a rating.
So what does it mean if you have an instrument rating?
Well, you can fly an instrument meteorological conditions. When, you know, there's clouds, you can fly through the clouds.
So, and that's basically trusting only the instruments?
That's correct.
Because you can't see anything?
That's right. If, yeah, you can be in heavy IFR where there's nothing but gray outside.
Do you ever find that there's an issue sometimes when you're flying over open water where you can lose the horizon and the sky blends in with the sea?
That's true. That people should rely on their instruments when that happens. Okay, and like Central Florida, it's very dark at night. You know, over the Everglades, there's nothing. So if you don't see a horizon there, you need to pay attention to the instruments, in particular the altimeter. Make sure you're flying the airplane straight and level.
And so if you don't have an instrument rating, you have to have good, clear visuality.
You have to fly in visual meteorological conditions.
So you're limited to that.
You're limited to that. That's right. There are specific rules about distance from cloud, visibility. So the FAA provides the rules, and they'll guarantee your safety if you follow the rules.
So, Leah, I wanted to ask you, how many hours of ground training is required, and how many hours must a pilot fly before they're able to fly solo?
Oh, goodness. Ed might be able to ask that question as an active flight instructor, but as part of your private pilot ground training, you're required to have so many ground hours on the ground with an instructor, or you may go through a flight school, official ground school. And I think, Ed, with the private, is it 55 hours or 50 hours, depending on what type of program you go through?
Well, I teach a 45-hour ground school through the Adult Community Education Program. A pilot has to have 40 hours of flight time. That's the minimum. I think the average is closer to about 70 before a person gets their license.
Before they're able to pass the testing?
Well, when they get their license and successfully pass the FAA check ride.
And those 40 hours, those have to be completed with an instructor next to them?
No. A certain amount of it. 30 of it is, they can do about 10 hours solo, but most people will do more than that. See, there's like in the specification, FAA specifies like 12 specific hours of instruction, and then that leaves about 8 for me. That's where required dual instruction. Then they've got the rest of it can be with an instructor or solo. The thing about it is they have to have solo, like fly cross country and so forth.
And so if somebody has an Ohio-issued license, for example, or something from another state, they can still fly in Florida. This is a national license?
It's a federal license, yes. We don't locally regulate the airspace.
Yeah, but there are things that are specific to Florida, though, that would be beneficial to know if you're going to be basing yourself in Florida.
The biggest difference is mountainous versus flat terrain like Florida, and then a lot of water flying like someone that flies in the islands, okay, versus over land.
Yeah, that would make it a different situation. Leah, were you going to say something?
Oh, no, I was just agreeing, and the conditions can be very different. So if you are a pilot and you're, say, I live up here in New England where you're used to flying in the conditions and the weather and the terrain with our mountains up here, then if you go down to Florida, you may be dealing with some convective weather activity that is a little bit different than what you experienced up here. So Ed may have experienced this too, but I would always suggest too, if a pilot's transferring from one area down to the other, it's always good to get in touch with one of the local flight schools and talk to a flight instructor and say, hey, what's different here, just to get a bigger sense of the environment of which you're flying.
Well, it's definitely not a bad idea. Ed, do people do that a lot?
Yes, I recommend it. Like some of my students have moved out to Colorado, and I say, you need to get with an instructor for mountain flying. So you tell them that. Some of them have gone up to Alaska. You need to get with an instructor in Alaska and have them brief you on the local area and talk about the conditions, because they're much different there.
Yeah, and also the fuel load that you're going to need in Alaska, because airports are not – it's a very large, large state, so you can get yourself kind of stuck. Earlier this month, a man who was training for his pilot's license crashed into the Everglades. And I don't want to talk about his specific situation so much, but are there sometimes misconceptions that pilots may have about crashing into the Everglades? Because it's called the Sea of Grass. People may think that there's solid land under there.
Well, at night, you know, it's very dark. I mean, you know, south of Orlando, everything is, you know, you can go long distances, and if there's a little bit of haze, you can't see very far. Same thing out over the water. So, you know, that's restricted visibility. Then people need to definitely rely on their instruments.
Yeah, but even in daytime, it just looks like flat land.
Yeah.
But it's swamp there. If somebody finds themselves in a spot of trouble over the Everglades, are there any suggestions you could give to somebody that's out there over the Everglades? Is there any place that's sort of safe to land?
The question you're asking, you know, which would you rather have, skill or luck?
Yeah.
I'd rather have luck. If that engine quits, I hope I'm over terrain that I can land the airplane. But sometimes a situation would be you're just having a bad day.
And you don't have an opportunity to make
a
choice.
You don't have an opportunity to make a choice, say, over downtown Fort Myers.
Yeah. There's a limited number of decisions that you can make and a very limited amount of time.
That's correct. Even like Sully, Sullenberger, okay, when he got the Canadian geese in the airplane, that flight's less than 3 minutes from takeoff to when he impacted the water. That's not a whole lot of time.
That's some quick decision-making. However, in flight training, if you have a twin-engine plane, you're going to be trained how to land that plane with just one engine operating and sometimes with zero engines operating. Do you do that in your training, too, with your single engines?
Yes. Yes, we fail the engine at altitude and, you know, practice that and do it to the student when they least expect it. Okay, try to do that. A lot of times I'll try to distract them doing something and then fail the engine. And then, you know, it's up to them. What are you going to do? And I'm questioning them.
Wow, talk about a pop quiz.
It is.
How do the students react?
Well, different people. Different people react differently. Most of the time, though, they learn. That's a teaching environment, teaching opportunity.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask Leah, with the NTSB, do you have any – or does the NTSB ever issue any kind of site-specific tips? For example, like I was asking Ed about being over the Everglades.
What we issue, we have – if you go to our NTSB.gov website, we have a tremendous amount of information for the public. And we have, in addition to issuing recommendations which can help improve safety, we also issue safety alerts. And there's a number of safety alerts, and those come created from something we may see that could use some extra highlight, if you will. And we have those there, and it's a great amount of information for pilots. They're just one or two pages. Sometimes we do a video associated with it. We're working on one right now for fuel exhaustion and fuel starvation. We've issued them for pilot reports, different fueling issues for the people who are grounding or fueling airplanes on the ground. So I would definitely suggest that if pilots are looking for some more information, they can go to our website and take a look at some of these safety alerts, and I think that they'd be very pleased with some of the information that they have a chance to read.
Yeah, and then it seems like it's also kind of one of those unique pockets of our culture in which being face-to-face and talking with pilots who have flown in that area is probably a brilliant course of action because you can learn a lot from the people on the ground, so to speak, no pun intended, about a given area and what peculiarities it might have.
One thing we try to impress on the students, like when they're learning, the license is a license to learn. You've got to keep going in like FAA websites. You can go in. There's all kinds of information, and you should continue to update yourself and stay current.
Mm-hmm. And so if somebody had a pilot's license maybe 10 years ago, is it still valid? How often do they have to re-up on classes?
Well, they take the flight review, and it's every 2 years.
Okay, so every 2 years you have to take a flight review.
Take a flight review no matter how much you fly, unless you've taken a check ride for a different rating. Say you were a private pilot and you were getting an instrument rating, then the 2 years starts from the date you've taken that last check ride.
Upgrading your license, kind of. So what does the check ride consist of? Do they have to have an instructor go with them in the air to make sure that they do things the way
they're supposed to? Well, the examiner, so you prepare them for the check ride as an instructor, and the examiner has a specific list of things.
Mm-hmm. We have a question coming in from Robert in Fort Myers. Robert, what would you like to ask?
Hey, good afternoon. Well, I've got about 1,100 hours in a single-engine airplane. I've been flying for about 10 years, and I think it was just mentioned that a license, when you get it, is a license to learn. And that's certainly been my experience. There's also a lot of resources online and some really good publications that, and of course the FAA has some good programs that highlight safety, and I've certainly availed myself to those. And that every one of the NTSB reports that comes out, there's lessons that can be learned. And, you know, if I internalize that information, maybe I don't have to make that mistake. I can learn from those mistakes, and that's certainly the way I try to approach it. I've advanced my education in flying.
And it sounds like it's something that somebody does, not just because it's on a lark. I mean, it's a lot of work to become a pilot and to get your license. So if you're doing that and you're doing all that work and spending all that energy, it sounds, Robert, like continuing that education would just kind of come naturally, or the desire to continue that education.
Pilots tend to be a bit of a different breed. You know, I think you sort of want to, you have a hunger for that information. I certainly do. You know, I'm advancing my training into multi-engine and, you know, stepping up into bigger airplanes and that sort of thing. And I do a lot of cross-country flying. So your questions earlier about flying over the Everglades or over open water, a lot of trips back and forth to the Keys. I tend to fly direct, if I can, Fort Myers to Key West over open water versus the coastline, which is counterintuitive, but if I go down, I'm talking to air traffic control. They know where I'm at. There's a lot of boat traffic on that line north to south. If I'm over on the coast, it's me and the alligators and the snakes.
Yeah.
A lot of people there, and there's no phone coverage. And, you know, so it's all those things are things that you're thinking about every time you go up. And you're expecting the engine, I certainly, every time I push the throttle forward on the runway, I'm expecting that to be the time the engine fails.
Yeah, you always got to be ready. I'd always got to be ready. All right. Thank you, Robert. That's an interesting perspective. And I wanted to ask one last question of Leah Reed. Even with smaller aircrafts, I wanted to ask about something new with these drones. Drones are taking up some airspace. Has the NTSB had any dealing with drones or interactions with small aircraft, particularly on takeoff and landing in airports?
I certainly see that there are several reports of close calls, especially in some of the bigger airports. But I don't know. I'm not aware of any instances that they've caused an incident or an accident.
Oh, so the NTSB hasn't really had to take any actions on that?
No, and some of the drones that we've, you know, that we work or investigated, some of the larger ones that maybe are down on the Border Patrol are using or operating, but no, not on the smaller ones with their interaction with aircraft in flight.
Yeah, just as a non-pilot, I kind of worried about that. Ed, have you seen any drones around Pagefield?
No.
Nope. All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there for now, but I want to thank our guest, Leah Reed with the National Transportation Safety Board. Thanks for being part of the show.
Thank you.
I also want to thank Ed Fink. He's a local flight instructor. I really appreciate your insight.
Thank you.
Coming up, it's called The Graying of Gay, and it's a look at the unique challenges our LGBT friends and neighbors face as they age. Up next, we'll talk to a doctor and attorney about what LGBT seniors need to know. I'm Julie Glenn. This is Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.